Good morning. The court calls United States v. Lee. Counsel for the appellant, please.
Good morning, Chief Judge Baker and honorable members of this court. I'm Colonel John Baker, and I, along with Mr. Gene Fidel and Captain Jason Wehrman, represent Captain Lee. On 20 July 2007, Captain Lee walked into his hometown sheriff's office in Claiborne, Texas, and registered as a sex offender. He did so despite the fact that his conviction arose from a flawed court-martial that did not provide him with a neutral and detached representative our justice system demands. Despite repeatedly demanding that his appeal be handled faster, Captain Lee lived his pariah existence on that registration list, subject to spot inspections at work, difficulties in obtaining professional licensing, limitations on attending family events at school, and other degrading restrictions for years longer than an effective and efficient appellate system would have allowed. Incredibly, after the NMCCA finally found quasi-structural error in the obvious conflict of interest and set aside Captain Lee's conviction, Captain Lee remained on the sex offender list because the trial counsel did not think it was the government's job to notify the Texas authorities that Captain Lee's conviction should be set aside.
All right, counsel. Let's cut to the chase here. Why isn't this all waived, minus the last 141 days?
Your Honor, there was
he entered an unconditional plea of guilty. Why isn't this waived under Ms. Gala and Bradley?
Your Honor, there was no affirmative waiver on the record. The military judge discussed the impact of waiving a number of things, the five-day delay and Article 32.
Does the judge have any sua sponte duty to tell him that?
No, sir.
Well, then why isn't it waived?
The issue isn't waived, Your Honor, because this court has consistently held that the post-trial delays are not waived if they're not raised during the normal appellate process. And this is because in Moreno, this court held that Article 66, like Article 10, grants greater rights than that of a pure Sixth Amendment analysis. In Moreno, this court explained that the military justice system, and I quote, provides...
Moreno's not a waiver case. Why isn't this waived?
This issue isn't waived, Your Honor, because Moreno establishes that Article 66 calls for anything greater diligence and timeliness is found in the civilian system.
Did he do a motion at the end? He filed a motion, did he not, regarding the delay?
Yes, sir.
And the judge denied it?
Yes, sir.
And then he pled guilty?
He didn't enter a conditional plea.
No.
Okay.
Did he have an alternative other than to plead guilty at that time?
I'm sorry, sir?
Did he have an alternative to pleading guilty if he wanted to pursue the delay issue?
Yes, sir. He had certainly an opportunity to plead not guilty. But Article 66, like Article 10, provides an accused greater rights than a pure Sixth Amendment analysis. So this court should look to the Miscala line of cases, 61 MJ 122, that holds that litigated Article 10 motions are not waived by a guilty plea. Similarly, this court should hold that litigated post-trial delay motions following a set-aside are not waived by a guilty plea.
No, you're asking us to extend the proposition.
Sorry, sir?
Are you asking us to extend the proposition you enunciated?
Yes, sir. I'm asking you to treat post-trial delay, which this court has in Moreno and a whole series of cases, held to a higher standard than normal Sixth Amendment litigation.
Counsel, in Bradley, we said that while the waiver doctrine is not without limits, those limits are narrow and relate to situations in which, on its face, the prosecution may not constitutionally be maintained. Was this a case where the error related to something where the case could not be constitutionally maintained?
Yes, sir.
How was that?
In the military justice system, unlike the civilian courts, in the military justice system, Article 66 holds a special place. And this court has consistently reviewed post-trial delay cases. I mean, even last week in Merritt, this court looked at post-trial delay. They have Article 66 provides an accused something beyond the protections of a straight Sixth Amendment analysis. Now, the court does look to the Sixth Amendment Barker v. Wingo analysis in determining if there is merit.
You're not saying it couldn't be. It couldn't be constitutionally maintained. That's a situation like double jeopardy.
Yes, sir.
That's not this situation.
No, sir, but
you may complain of the delays, but that doesn't mean that the prosecution cannot constitutionally go forward.
Your Honor, on the what the appellant's position is that Article 66, like Article 10, occupies a special place.
It may. It may. The CCAs have unique powers under Article 66, but that doesn't answer the question of why this isn't waived.
This isn't waived, Your Honor, under the same rationale.
Could you speak up as well?
This is not waived under the same rationale that Article 10 waivers are not waived if raised in FAR. In Niskala 61 MJ, I got the specific site. At 61 MJ 122, this court has held that Article 10 motions are not waived by a guilty plea. And it's the appellant's position that post-trial delay should be treated the same way. And if you look at post-trial delay cases, if an accused in a normal post-trial delay case, the fact that it wasn't raised at the trial level or even at the NMCCA doesn't waive the issue. In this case, it was the post-trial delay issue was waived as soon as the NMCCA took action on the conflict of interest issue. So it's the appellant's position, again, that issue is not waived. If this court finds waiver, then this case is certainly open. So assuming that the court doesn't find waiver, then the Barker v. Winger, the appellant's position, the Barker v. Winger analysis should be applied. The first thing you need to look at is the length of the delay. In this case, the delay was facially unreasonable. Captain Lee was sentenced more than 8 years ago. More than 7 years ago, he placed the appellate court on notice of the potential conflict of interest. He filed an affidavit for his first pleading. This court ordered a debate fact-finding hearing into this conflict more than 5 years ago. And it took the lower courts more than 3 years to conduct the required fact-finding. You need to look at the reasons for the delay. The reasons for the delay: government indifference and judicial incompetence. It took the government more than a year to get Captain Lee's case initially docketed with the NMCCA. There were three Dubay hearings ordered in this case. All three Dubay hearings took longer than the time set by the JAG.
Could you describe in terms of what is in the record, citing two elements of the record, Dubay record, that is, the second military judge's, second Dubay judge's conflict or recusal issue and how you perceive it? It was the second Dubay judge, was it not, that the CCA said should have recused or was required?
No, sir, it was the first Dubay
judge. Okay, so same question, first judge. Could you describe for us, using the record, what exactly the first military judge, what that recusal was based on and why it should have been obvious and apparent at the get-go rather than after the CCA had analyzed it?
Yes, sir. The first Dubay judge...
Is that a rational question now?
Yes, sir. Okay. The first Dubay judge was essentially a fact witness. And we put the Dubay judge on notice...
Was essentially a what?
A fact witness, Your Honor. And if you go to Joint Appendix at 221, there's an email string between the first Dubay judge and the parties laying out the Dubay judge's facts of why he was associated with this case. At Joint Appendix 224, and 225, it from the record shows where we challenged the DuBay judge because he was a fact witness. The DuBay judge came to Camp Lejeune and served as the supervisory military justice officer during part of the period with which Captain Lee's case originally arose.
That answers my question. Thank you.
The all three DuBay hearings took a substantial amount of time. The first and second DuBay hearing started. The first DuBay hearing didn't even begin 4 months after the JAG set the deadline for the hearing to conclude. The second hearing occurred 3 months after the second, began 3 months after the deadline was set for the hearing to conclude. Another reason for the delay, besides the fact that Judge Ward should have recused himself, was once this issue came to the forefront after the first DuBay hearing, the case was headed to the NMCCA. The appellant moved the NMCCA to stop the process and just send it back for a new DuBay hearing without an obviously conflicted judge. The NMCCA declined to do that, but instead held the case for 6 more months before sending back for exactly what we had asked for in the spring. When the case goes back for the second DuBay hearing, the second DuBay judge did not do the required fact-finding that was needed.
What does the record reflect, not what you know, but what does the record reflect as to why the appellant did not testify at the first or second DuBay hearing?
The record does not reflect any discussion of whether or not the appellant, why the appellant.
So from our standpoint, all we know is that there's an affidavit at the first two and testimony at the third.
Yes, sir. And there's also in the record some email traffic between the appellant and his civilian counsel that laid out the appellant's understanding of the conflict of interest issue. And I apologize, I don't have the record set.
No, I know that email trail. Thank you. So nothing on the specific issue that you're drawing our attention to on whether to testify at the first, second debate hearing?
No, sir. There's nothing in the record. Just the record is that the appellant didn't testify.
Right. Okay.
The appellant's position that the appellant wasn't required to testify, and that the record, there's nothing that occurred in the third debate hearing other than the fact that the appellant took the stand that is different than what was in the record of the second debate hearing. Because the second debate hearing contains that email that I just discussed that shows that the appellant's understanding was with a conflict of interest with his detailed defense counsel. The overall, the NFCCA reviewed the conflict of interest issue 4 times before it finally granted relief. The third thing to look at is the assertion of the right. This court should ask, did the appellant assert his right to a speedy trial, a speedy appellate review? The appellant as is clearly laid out in the brief, the appellant asserted his right 5 separate times for a speedy appellate review. The next question to ask is, was there prejudice? Given the egregious delay, there's no showing of prejudice is required. But on this record, Captain Lee was prejudiced. He was required to register as a sex offender. For his health, that's a particularized anxiety required by case law in Moreno. Sheriff deputies came to his office to check on his face and name. It was placed on the internet. It took him longer to find work and to get an insurance license. Additionally, after his conviction was set aside, it took the government a number of months to remove him from the registered sex offender list.
Did he receive any credit for that or any sort of recognition of that by the military judge?
He did, Your Honor. He received some Article 13 credit. Basically day-for-day credit for under Article 13 that still establishes under Parker v. Wingo analysis prices.
The Article 13 credit was for what?
The Article 13 credit was for the 120-something days.
And the delay in getting him off the register? Okay, so he got day-for-day credit for that.
Day-for-day for pretrial punishment under Article 13.
But your argument is that was curative but not curative enough.
Yes, sir. And that in establishing the prejudice, that establishes prejudice under the Barker v. Wingo analysis as well. I see that my time is drawing close. May I conclude?
You may.
As I just articulated, under the Barker v. Wingo analysis, Captain Lee's post-trial rights to a speedy post-trial delay were violated in this case. The only appropriate remedy on this record, based on the judicial incompetence coupled with the recklessness in allowing Captain Lee to remain as a registered sex offender, despite having his conviction set aside, dismissal with prejudice is the only appropriate remedy in this case.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for the government, please.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Major Paul Overstein, along with Mr. Brian Keller. I represent the United States. Any delay that occurred during the first appeal before appellant's unconditional guilty plea is not a due process violation now for two reasons. First, the unconditional nature of the guilty plea waived the right to assert any error from earlier delays. And second, even if this Court were to look at those delays, there was not a due process violation. Balancing all the four Barker factors, especially the last three factors, which weigh strongly against finding a due process violation. Now, first, it's important to start with the unconditional nature of appellant's guilty plea, because he negotiated a PTA that was very favorable for him and included a number of favorable provisions, but he did not negotiate for a conditional guilty plea under RCM 910. Now, it's important to compare this case to Danilo, which was argued just yesterday. The cases are very similar in that you have a period of delay to litigate something on appeal. In Danilo, it was Article 62 appeal, whereas here it was normal Article 66 review. But the appellant wants his case treated exactly like that case, where the appellant there specifically negotiated a conditional guilty plea, preserving the right to appeal that issue. Appellate had every opportunity to do the same, to enter a conditional plea, but he did not negotiate for that. But yet he wants now to have the exact same benefit as the appellant in Danilo, who did enter a conditional plea. Now, holding such would make a conditional guilty plea under the RCM meaningless. There's no need for an appellant to enter into that conditional plea if he gets all the benefits entering an unconditional plea as he would have got had he entered a conditional plea.
What effect, if any, does the fact that he, through a motion, sought relief and the military judge denied it, how does that affect, change, alter, strengthen, weaken the waiver argument that you're making?
It has no, whether he litigated the issue at the trial level has no impact on the waiver. The waiver is due to the entry of the guilty plea itself, when he unconditionally pled guilty. So it didn't matter that he litigated this issue. Certainly, he would have waived it as well had he not litigated it. But it goes to the voluntary nature of his plea. I mean, he can attack the two claims that he can make now are ineffective assistance of counsel, or he can say that his plea was involuntary. Those are the two issues that remain on appeal at this point. Now, certainly the fact that the military judge, that he knew that the military judge denied this motion, and then he went through the lengthy Providence inquiry after that, saying, yes, I still want to plead guilty. I understand what I'm doing. I'm fully aware of all my rights. Knowing that the military judge had already denied this motion, that certainly makes the case that this plea was voluntary much stronger than had he not known that.
Did the government raise the waiver issue at the CCA?
Yes, Your Honor.
And did the CCA rule on it?
They did not rule on that.
And did they make a decision on the merits of his due process claims?
It's the CCA's opinion is rather short, but it appears that they did deny it on the merits. And if you look at a case, United States versus Angle, I think that's in the 1MJ at 388, that says when the United States argues waiver at the CCA and the CCA simply denies it on the merits outright, I mean, that waiver issue is preserved. We can still argue that now in front of this court. And that's part and parcel of the granted issue. I mean, this, the granted issue is, did the CCA err in finding no due process violation? And our answer to that is no. There was no due process violation because the clock starts when he entered his guilty plea on the 13th of March, 2012. Everything else before that was waived. So looking at that short period, there was no due process violation. If you look at the another thing I want to draw attention to is if you look at the joint appendix on page 172 to 174, the appellant agrees in his PTA that all of the confinement that he served during the first appeal was pretrial confinement. Now, the effects of that, stipulating that this was pretrial confinement, is then he gets credit for that. Automatic forfeitures don't apply, and he gets paid more money as a result of that. So what he's saying now is, for the purposes of calculating my pay, treat the delay during the first appeal as a pretrial delay. But when you're formulating a waiver rule, that's totally irrelevant. It's not similar to pretrial delay. It's not similar to Sixth Amendment speedy trial delay, which would be waived by the unconditional guilty plea.
Just to be clear on the waiver argument, you're just arguing the facts of this case, that his plea in this case waived ADP. You're not saying a unconditional plea henceforth would waive ADP, which would necessarily and more often occur after a plea.
That's correct, Your Honor.
You're not here trying to make some broader statement. You're just saying, in this case.
No, Your Honor, it's the delay that occurred before the guilty plea. I mean, under the normal course, post-trial delay is not going to occur before the guilty plea.
Okay, no, I'm just making sure that I understand the specificity with which you're making your argument.
Yes, Your Honor, we're not articulating a broad waiver rule where...
Could I turn you to your statement earlier that all three Barker v. or the last three Barker v. Wingo factors favor the government?
Yes, Your Honor.
You have two things here that are somewhat remarkable. One, that you had a trial counsel, a defense counsel, also serving as trial counsel at the same time as one of the reasons for the delay. And in fact, doing it so much at the same time that the Dubé judge found that in one case, the defense counsel, the same person, did a trial from the defense table and then without going out of the courtroom just moved over to the trial counsel table and prosecuted the next case. That seems an odd reason for delay. That's a fairly obvious conflict of interest, is it not?
Yes.
Admittedly, that's not, that particular scenario was discovered during the debate process, but to say that a conflict like that, delaying a case, should not weigh against the government, on that factor strikes me as a somewhat peculiar argument.
Yes, Your Honor, it is. I mean, the conflict itself, even if we say that...
You would agree it would be peculiar if you both switched places right now and started to argue a different case.
Yes, Your Honor, I do agree that would be...
So then the government's not trying to validate that?
No, Your Honor.
Is there anything in the record that indicates whether the government has taken any steps to make sure that doesn't happen?
I don't believe that's in the record, but in part of the pleadings, I think the defense pointed out in their brief that the Marine Corps has changed its structure, and this did lead to fundamental changes within the Marine Corps as a result of this conflict. So, I mean, that was the reason for CCA's first opinion. They showed absolutely no prejudice, and while I agree that the conflict itself may have been obvious, the showing that was going to be required at the debate hearing was anything but clear, as this court's first opinion makes out. I mean, what showing appellant would have to make as far as prejudice.
I'm just looking at the reasons right now. I just wanted to see whether there's anything in the record that would help prevent this from happening again. Do you agree with the appellant that the first military judge's recusal requirement or whatever, conflict or whatever it was obvious at the time?
No, Your Honor, we don't. I mean, it was fully disclosed to the defense. It was something that, in hindsight, the CCA found that he should have disqualified himself. But to say at the time that that was obvious and he should have known that is not entirely clear.
What was the disqualification requirement, and why was it or was it not obvious at the time?
Well, the disqualification was because he had taken over for the military justice officer who was previously Captain Ray, the original trial defense counsel supervisor. So he took over as a predecessor and had sat in and observed some of these trials. So potentially he could have had independent knowledge, but he fully disclosed that, invited voir dire on that issue. So to say that just his knowledge was patently obvious that he should have disqualified himself, I think is a bit of a stretch. But if we look at the reasons for the delay as a whole, I mean, this was a fairly complicated issue that had to be litigated at the debate rooms. And as the military judge's findings made clear, there were six witnesses that needed to testify at these debate hearings. They were all attorneys. Presumably, they all had their own trial schedules. That's the joint appendix at page 243. So, I mean, getting all these debate schedules and finding all these facts is not something that could be done relatively quickly. And particularly, appellant takes issue with the need for the third debate hearing, but that third debate hearing was entirely due to the appellant's own actions. He could have testified at the first two debate hearings. And the fact that the CCA gave him another chance to carry his burden should not weigh against the government now. This was the issue at the third debate hearing was entirely at that point a credibility issue. His attorney said that he had disclosed this conflict to appellant. But the CCA apparently was not willing to disregard that or disbelieve that based purely on an affidavit. But appellant could have testified at the first two debate hearings, or the second one in particular, and that would have eliminated any need for a third debate hearing. So that factor should not weigh against the United States now. Turning to the assertion of the right to timely review, appellant never raised this issue with the CCA in 2011. And if you look at his appeal now, what he's essentially taken issue with is he's appealing the remedy from the lower court that they devised in 2011. Because they set aside his first conviction and sent it back for a rehearing. Essentially what he's saying now is they should have, instead of setting it aside and authorizing a rehearing, they should have set it aside with prejudice because of the delay that had occurred before that opinion in 2011. But he never made that claim at the time, in 2011. His appeal had been pending for 6 years, and he never once raised that issue with the CCA. So it seems difficult for him to say now that he asserted the right to timely review. Why wasn't this issue raised in 2011 then, when the court could have granted some sort of revised a remedy to send it back or to remedy this if they had found that post-trial delay had occurred? And finally, prejudice. I mean, the whole prejudice argument for appellant turns on the statement that if this case had been resolved years earlier, I would have been taken off the sex offender registry years earlier. So he's looking at the favorable position that he's in now and then making the leap that I would have came to that same conclusion or I would have got the same result if this case had been resolved years earlier. We don't think that's entirely clear. That's a bit of a stretch to say you would have got that same result had this case been resolved years earlier, particularly when the delay allowed him to reach that favorable result. The lower court cited the delay in its opinion setting aside the findings and sentence. Appellant relied on the delay before the lower court in 2011, talking about how the attorney's testimony was not credible because of the shifting narratives over time, the destruction of case files, his inability to remember other details. So it's not entirely clear that would have turned out the same had the case been resolved earlier. And particularly at the retrial, I mean, the entire case was different at the rehearing in 2012 than it was originally in 2006. If this case had been resolved sooner, it certainly would have much closer resembled the first trial in 2006. So balancing all those factors indicates that there was no due process violation, even if we were to look at the delay that occurred before the guilty plea. But all the delay that occurred before the guilty plea, again, our position is that was clearly waived. And the appellant's argument to the contrary, that we should create some sort of exception similar to Article 10, we do not believe that this court should do that because Article 10 has a specific statutory purpose and specific statutory language where that exception Congress clearly intended to give a broader right to service members under Article 10. And there's entirely different reasons for Article 10 as opposed to the delay that's in this case. Article 10, the person is in confinement, not serving their sentence, but awaiting trial. And there also is some concern maybe if Article 10 motions were waived, I mean, it's at least conceivable that there's a concern with the voluntary nature of the plea, that people might be pleading guilty just to get out of pretrial confinement. So there's those issues as well, or at least reasons why we say that those type of motions are not waived. But here, this is raised as a due process issue. And under the Due Process Clause, service members don't have greater due process rights than civilians. There is no concept of military due process as there was in previous cases. So whether this is raised as a due process issue or a Sixth Amendment speedy trial issue, the nature of the right that he's asserting is similar. RCM 707E says that a guilty plea waives any speedy trial issues related to that offense. So it doesn't say Sixth Amendment speedy trial issues raised solely under the Sixth Amendment. It simply says speedy trial issues. So here, even though he's raising this as a due process issue, he's saying that you can't go forward with my guilty plea because of delay that occurred before my guilty plea. You can't accept this guilty plea. You need to set it aside because it took too long for the government to get me to that point. That's almost identical to the Sixth Amendment speedy trial issue that under this court's precedent is clearly waived by the entry of an unconditional guilty plea. So again, we don't think there's any reason to make that distinction between a conditional plea and an unconditional plea meaningless. That has to mean something. Appellant could have entered a conditional plea, and he chose not to. He's not attacking the voluntariness of his plea at this point. He's not raising an IAC. He's simply saying that his guilty plea should be set aside based on delay that occurred earlier. But this court should not do that. It should uphold the bargain for agreement that he negotiated for in his PTA and uphold his guilty plea at this point. If there are no further questions.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for the appellant, rebuttal, please.
His argument, the appellate government...
A little louder, please.
His argument, the appellate government counsel talked about what should happen under the normal course. This case was anything but normal. The appellate government counsel is asking this court to convert post-trial delay and make it synonymous with basically RCM 707 pretrial delay. There is no law stands for the conversion of the delay of that sort of conversion of post-trial delay and a pre-trial delay. And that is why in post-trial delay jurisprudence, failure to raise post-trial delay doesn't waive the issue. This court should look to Article 10 jurisprudence and, as in Ms. Gala, hold that a litigated post-trial delay motion is preserved for appeal. Congress clearly has intended to give service members greater rights in the appellate process under Article 66 than their civilian counterparts enjoy. This court has held that Article 66 does provide a service member with greater protections than Article 6th Amendment under the Moreno line of cases. Appellate Government Counsel talked about there being no prejudice in this case. Captain Lee remained a registered sex offender. We know from July until February when he was removed from the sex offender list. That's the established delay. It's not speculation to say that should have happened faster. Because of the obvious conflict of interest that the Chief Judge asked the Government Counsel about. Captain Lee's defense counsel worked for the prosecutor. He had his fitness report written by the prosecutor. The result of the Lee case fundamentally changed the way defense services are provided in the Marine Corps. We dropped a footnote citing a McClatchy article in our brief that does provide that in the record. The DuBay judge at the first DuBay hearing sat in court at an Article 32 hearing and watched Captain Ray's defense counsel, when acting as a trial counsel, perform as a government prosecutor. That was one of the litigated issues. That conflict was obvious. The delay in the Duvet judge and Judge Ward refusing to recuse himself when that issue was raised prior to trial in a manner so as not to delay that debate, the first Duvet hearing. And then the NMCCA not just sending that case back when they saw that in a conflict of interest case, a case is sent for a Duvet to get fact-finding on a conflict of interest. The judiciary assigns a conflicted judge to make that determination. In 2009, at Joint Appendix 130, Captain Lee demanded that his case be handled faster. They complained about the post-trial delay in detail. This was one of five demands for this case to be handled faster. For the government counsel to stand up and say that the last three Barker v. Wingo factors were not met by the defense, it's just simply not supported by the record. Captain Lee was prejudiced. He demanded that his case, he asserted his right to speedy post-trial review. And the reasons for the delay are unjustifiable. It took the NMCCA and the lower courts more than 3 years to answer a very simple fact-finding, make a very simple fact-finding determination. They had to call six witnesses. This wasn't hard, it wasn't complicated, and they had to call six witnesses, and then we had the record, the email that demonstrates what Captain Lee's understanding was regarding the issue of a knowing waiver of the conflict of interest. On this record, the only appropriate relief is dismissal with prejudice. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The court thanks both counsel. The case is now submitted, and we'll stand in recess until 10:20. Thank you very much.
Court stands in recess until 10:20.